This morning, I am full of apologies. I apologize for the fragrant odor which is pervading the house. We are this morning, being the third Sunday of the month, we are beginning our two service projects, one at the nursing home and one with the parents of overseas children from overseas. So we are feeding them this morning. I apologize for not giving it to everybody, and also there's a board meeting, so all of those people are getting food and the others are not. That's very, very unfair. But if you come next Sunday, you'll get fed. It's a potluck. And next Sunday is Sri Ramakrishna's birthday celebration. You come, you'll all be welcome to eat at that time. And the other thing I have to apologize for is many of you I know have not had courses in history, Western history. And what I have to talk about today and what I have to say in the other discourses on sages of the West require, for full comprehension, a considerable background in history and the politics and sociology of the West. And there are many of you who have that, have done that, gone through that, but there are others who have not. And so to them, my apologies for speaking primarily this morning to those who are familiar with the history of religion in the West. You see, the history of religion in the East is so different from the history of religion in the West. In the East, I have to say these things by preamble, in the East, nothing was ever considered heretical. Well, I won't say not considered heretical, but if they thought things were heretical, they didn't do anything about it. Everything was welcome. In the Indian mentality, in the fold of Indian religion, all sheep are white sheep, more or less. So it becomes a question of if you disagreed with somebody, you politely shouted at him, but you didn't try to put his neck under the block, on the block, or put him into the fire. So that's the history of religion in the East. And we're very glad that it is. The history of religion in the West has been very, very different. What we call the church, which was the Roman church, the Holy Roman Empire first, and then the Roman Catholic Church, became so powerful and so all-pervading and all-encompassing and demanding that forces had to rebel against it, and science had to be born in the West in spite of it, not because of the fostering of religion, but in spite of the objections of religion. Science was born. The Renaissance came. The Reformation came. All of these movements in Western history came in opposition to religion. Religion was opposed to most, almost all of these things. That is the thing you have to understand when you try to approach a person like Bruno, whom we're discussing today. In this series, Sages of the West, we have come to, I hope, a sage, Giordano Bruno, an Italian, born in 1548 and dying in 1600. I want to begin by quoting first from his writings, because his life will not have nearly so much meaning for us without some of the writings that we from which we draw in our discourse. So these are some of the things that he wrote or said, and then we'll get into his life after that. Our world of sense perception is built on sense perception is built not on absolute values, but on certain observed relationships. He who desires to philosophize must first of all doubt all things. He must not assume a position in a debate before he has listened to various opinions and considered and compared the reasons for and against. He must never judge or take up a position on the evidence of what he has heard, on the opinion of the majority, the age, the merits, or prestige of the speaker concerned. But he must proceed according to the persuasion of an organic doctrine which adheres to real things and to a truth that can be understood by the light of reason. I have to warn you that Bruno's writings and speeches are not easy to understand. The language is sometimes quite abstruse, but if you listen carefully, I think you'll get the sagesse, the wisdom that is coming through it. If one denies the existence of a thing merely because it cannot be apprehended by the senses, he would soon be led to the denial of his own substance and being. Did you get that? Let me do it again. If one denies the existence of a thing merely because it cannot be apprehended by the senses, he would soon be led to the denial of his own substance and being. He sees the oneness of the microcosm and the macrocosm. If you're going to start denying things because you can't see them and doubt the invisible, and you will have to wind up doing the same on yourself. Of what use, then, are the senses? They are useful for stimulating our reason to indicate, but not to judge. And then this, which Thursday night people will respond to quickly. Truth resides in the senses as objects do in a mirror. Truth resides in the senses as objects do in a mirror. In Thursday night, we've been studying Shankaracharya. Shankara is pointing out how the doctrine of Maya can be illustrated by pointing to the face in the mirror. Where does the face come from? Where does the face go, which is seen in the mirror? Same with Maya. Reason, says Bruno, is the great arbiter of everything. God is perfect and has perfect freedom. I don't think you realize how contrary these are to the church doctrines. A universal intellect fills the whole, illumines the universe, and directs nature to the production of species. A universal intellect fills the whole, illumines the universe, and directs nature to the production of species. There is a universal spirit fusing all into a single universal whole. And the soul of the individual is continuous with the soul of the universe. If the universe is spherical, then the space beyond it, adjoining it, must be spherical also. Space is spherical, according to Bruno. Bruno was an astronomer of sorts. He was a geometer and a mathematician. But mostly he was a pursuer of the sciences of the occult and the sciences of the spirit. Time, space, matter. Each is infinite and they merge. I don't think that was said until Einstein. Does anybody know if it was said before Einstein, except by Bruno? Time, space, and matter. Each is infinite and they merge. The universe and all its parts are, in quotes, alive. Now to me that means there's consciousness there. He calls it alive and puts that in quotes. He hasn't a better word for it. But all the universe and all its parts are alive. And wisdom equals truth equals unity. Wherever there is wisdom, there is unity. Wherever there is unity, there is truth. Wherever there is truth, there is wisdom and unity. These are some of the quotations that I can give you right off for Bruno, his writings. Many of them have been lost. Many of them were burned and destroyed. We don't have anywhere near the number of volumes that he wrote. Well, now I should like to go into his life. An Italian born near Naples in 1548. He was a philosopher, a mystic, a proto-scientist, that means a scientist before science was properly born. He has no system. Unfortunately, I cannot delineate for you Bruno's system of thought because he doesn't have one. He had no single discipline. He studied no single discipline, so you can't put him in a pigeonhole and say he was a mathematician or he was a philosopher or this or that. His mind accepted no limitations. Very broad, ranging mind. He studied all kinds of things. He studied alchemy. He studied magic. He studied whatever was available to him of ancient religions, religions from the Roman pagans, religions from Greece. He studied all of that, and he studied Judaism. And there was nothing that he didn't study, and his mind accepted no limitations. When I learned that he was fiery and abrasive, I began to wonder whether I had chosen a sage or not. And I still am not sure, perfectly sure, that we should call anyone a sage who gets as upset as Bruno did. But he had reason to get upset, may I say. He was fiery and abrasive, and he fought back with his mind and his voice, his speech and his writings, his pen. He fought back his enemies. He courted danger and controversy all his life. And you will see how that happened. He is probably the most loathed heretic of all history. Yes. The church loathes Bruno of all of the heretics it burned and condemned. He was the son of a soldier. Maybe you know a bit why he showed that Kshatriya temperament. He was brought up in that kind of a family. He entered a Dominican monastery at the age of 15. That tells you the kind of times he lived in. The church was so all-powerful, so pervading the culture, and so domineering and dominant over the life of even the little towns where he came from was called, what's it called? Napoli or something. Something like Naples. That was Cusco. That's Nicholas. This was another little town. It starts with N. I can't remember what it was. He was in the monastery at 15 and caught reading Erasmus. Now, to read Erasmus was the greatest sin possible at that time. Erasmus was, until Bruno, the most hated agnostic and atheist by the church. He was considered just out of bounds, completely over the hill, and he was popular with all of the people who were coming up into the time of the Renaissance, the people who were leading the leading lights, intellectual lights of the awakening of the human mind in that period. And Erasmus is what he was reading, so he was caught. And at 24, he ran away from the monastery, for which I can't blame him. And he ran away and went wandering from monastery to monastery. He was always devoted to the church. He never openly fought the church. He never felt the church was his enemy in any generic sense, in any basic sense of basic conviction. He tried to be a Catholic and didn't succeed in any way, but he never lost that adherence and loyalty that his early life had engendered in him. So he went from monastery to monastery seeking support for his ideas. He wanted to find other rebels, other people in other monasteries who were rebellious and would support the ideas that were coming to him so thick and fast. A tremendous brain, the ideas just poured through him. And so he didn't find them. He went from place to place, and a few he found, he drew a few people to him, but he didn't really find anybody who would come out and back him up. You see, the intelligentsia of that time were, like today, expecting to find that one great hidden truth which would tie everything together. We do that now. We're looking for the common denominator, what do you call it now? The
unified field
theory that will tie all of our knowledge together. Well, they were looking for that at the time in the 16th century. They were looking for all of that. And he was, of course, also searching for it. But because it didn't, his discoveries didn't tie everything together, nobody backed him up. Well, in his travels through Europe, he eventually reached Rome. He didn't feel any sense of danger about it. He didn't know that to go to Rome was probably one of the worst things he could have done, because here was Father Church, Mother Church, Father Pope, and everybody was there, and that was his place. But when he got to Rome, he discovered that in absentia, he had been excommunicated.
That's usually how it happens.
Hmm?
That's usually how it happens.
Yes. He was excommunicated, which means, for those of you who come from India, that means you can't be a Hindu anymore. You couldn't be a Christian anymore. You couldn't be called a Christian. You couldn't go to the altar and take the bread and the wine. You couldn't have the office. You couldn't say the office. You couldn't hear the office. He became a priest.
He was a priest.
Right?
That means that his writings are published by that time.
Some of them, yes, yes. Some of them had been published, and his reputation had gone round. And Rome was very much down on him and found that his publications were off the books, and so he was excommunicated. So what did he do? He wandered all through Europe. He stayed in filthy inns, places you and I wouldn't even walk into, were hostels in those days, where people who were not in the upper classes had to journey, and he stayed in these places and complains about their filth and the rats and all that. But he says there I met poets, philosophers, beatniks. I said that. But that's the kind of people he met there. And, so thinkers. He met thinkers. He gained supporters. He found people who would go at least partway with him on his ideas and who sympathized with the fact that he had been cast out by the church. And so, wandering like this, he got to Milan and ultimately to Geneva. Now, Geneva was what? The headquarters of the Protestants. Geneva was the headquarters of the Calvinists, the people who had followed John Calvin out of the church. And he expected that there he would find support for his rebelliousness, and that they would sympathize with him and uphold his special doctrines. He was always so optimistic. He always felt the truth would conquer. We say satyam eva jayate. He was convinced that the truth would make everybody see the light. And so he went to Geneva full of faith and hope and approached the Calvinist leaders saying to them, "Here it is. Don't you agree with me?" And he got as cold a reception in Geneva as anywhere else in Europe. He was far too heretical, far too far out for the Calvinists, Protestants. And that was very disappointing to him. So you must realize, to understand this, you have to realize, at that time, Aristotle's view was the world view, and Aristotle's description of the physical world was the only true one. And as John Dobson has pointed out to me a number of times, Aristotle made any number of mistakes. But Aristotle was accepted as the authority on the universe, on its configuration, on its origin and its development. And so, if you were not alongside of Aristotle, and Bruno criticized Aristotle greatly, then you were out of favor. Well, imagine, this is what Bruno said, there are countless suns and infinite planets. Countless suns and an infinity of planets. But if that's true, then what about the church dogma that Jesus is the only Savior? There cannot be planets like ours with life on them where Jesus has not gone, and you're upsetting all theology. He said the essence of a bee is indistinguishable from the essence of a human being. A mineral is as important as a pope.
He said that.
A mineral is as important as a pope. And get this, no, there is no absolute position in space. Position of a body is relative to that of others. The observer is always at the center. This is quantum stuff. This is quantum stuff. Amazing. 1550.
One more time, Swamiji, the last one.
Yes. There is no absolute position in space. The position of a body is relative to that of other bodies. The observer is always at the center.
You can see why that's heretical.
Oh, yes. Terrible.
Because if the earth is the center of the universe, and Jerusalem is the pole point of which all and hell is directly down from
right.
that, and heaven is directly down. This was exactly
that's what the picture. Believed. Picture of the universe that they had. That's right.
To say anything else.
That's right. See, in India, you can have Puranas, which give all kinds of fancy geography. But you never pretend, I hope you never pretend, that this is actual physical geography. You know that this is a Purana. Christian church never understood that its Bible was a Purana. That is the problem. It took it as literal gospel science.
Still does.
And so, in many places still does. So, anyway, these are the things he said. Oh, and another, and the last thing I wanted to quote at that point is, all this does not diminish our importance. It expands it.
Wow.
You see, the church would say, all of this dwarfs man, put if you have infinite planets and many suns, innumerable suns, then man's place becomes so small. No, he said. The observer is always at the center. This expands our importance, not diminishes it. Well, he had investigated Lutheranism and rejected it. See, you have to realize that Galileo had not yet convinced the world that the sun didn't go around the earth. That happened in this century, that century, but that hadn't yet become popular, hadn't yet become accepted. In fact, it wasn't accepted, and he had to recant. But anyway, Bruno investigated all of the things which were heretical at the time, and Lutheranism was, of course, the biggest enemy of the church. And he investigated it, but he didn't take to it. He rejected it. So he goes back to France. And his one big idea was, if I can only get an important political figure to see the truth of what I'm saying, espouse it, and publicize it, my case is made. I will be saved from perdition or whatever. From the power of the church, if I can get somebody to back me up. So he went to France and he got Henry III to listen to him and admire him and entertain the possibility that his ideas were right. And Henry III gave him a post at the University of Padua in Italy. And he taught at the University of Padua for a year at the same time that Galileo was there. We do not have any record of his having met Galileo, but we know that they were there teaching at the same time, and so undoubtedly they met each other. Unfortunately, Henry III died untimely, and all of that support in France disappeared. He was betrayed, he was trapped. His writings and his speeches were recorded and sent to the church in Rome, to the Pope and the Vatican. And so he had to escape again. This time he went to England. You think that's a safe place? Safe from the church, you know? So he went off to England and he said, I must make a friend of Queen Elizabeth first. And he did. He made a friend of Elizabeth I. And she listened to him for a while. And then, for some reason, we don't know exactly why, she turned cool too. And he was not able to put her into his camp. And he did make a friend in England, whose name was Philip Sidney, Sir Philip Sidney. Sir Philip Sidney became the friend and companion, a very close companion of Bruno. So he did make one, but Sidney was not right in the center of things either. Sidney was out on the verge, on the margins, and didn't really have much influence. And so, having made friends with Elizabeth, You can imagine what that did to his reputation in the Vatican. Well, having failed to find a powerful political figure, what do you suppose his optimism chose next? What?
Where he went next?
Yes.
Right.
No, he went straight to the church itself. He said, I'm going to make a convert of the Pope.
Wow. He's asking for it.
He wants one more.
See, he believed in his religion. He believed that the Catholic religion was true. As far as religion was concerned, he believed in the spirituality of the Christian faith. He believed in the Christian faith as the giver of all the things the church gives when it's not talking science and geography. The spiritual value of the church was very prominent in his mind, and he thought that he would persuade the intellect. He would persuade the intellect of the Pope against the doctrines. And what he said was, the intellect should be absolutely free and above faith. Now, you're going to go to the Pope and tell him that the intellect should stand above faith? How are you going to do that? Well, of course he couldn't, and let me show you some of the reasons why he couldn't, very obvious reasons why he couldn't. Bruno had no place for a personal God. That might surprise you, but he didn't. He had no place in his philosophy for a personal God. He said, we are one with God, and we are continuous, the soul of man is continuous with the soul of the universe. There's no need for a personal God. He said that Christ was a representative of this universal spirit and not one with it. The Holy Trinity in a Christian sense.
Doesn't that negate his whole thing? He's just saying that something isn't one.
Yeah, but he not with one with God in the Christian dogma sense. The Father, the Son and the Father, that sense. Mm-hmm. He said that the Holy Trinity is only a semantic distinction. You've got the Son proceeding from the Father and this Holy Ghost proceeding from the Father. And I mean, these dogmas and doctrines are there. And Bruno is saying, it's a semantic distinction. Wonderful. I guaranteed to convince the Pope. Well, they're going to read a quotation, another quotation from him here. Now I understand all attributes to be one and the same in deity. And with theologians and the greatest thinkers, I conceive of three attributes, power, wisdom, and goodness, or mind, comprehension, and love. To me this is Sat-Chit-Ananda. Sat is comprehension. He calls it mind. Universal mind, but that's all right. Then comprehension is chit, of course. Chit and anand, love is ananda. So here's you got this trinity. The other one was power, wisdom, and goodness as attributes of deity. Yes. I conceive of three attributes for deity. Now remember, I understand all attributes to be one and the same in the deity. But with theologians and the great thinkers, I conceive of these three attributes, power, wisdom, and goodness. Or, mind, comprehension, and love. Things are through mind. There's the sat. They are ordered and distinct through intellect. And they are harmonious, in harmonious proportion, through universal love. In all and above all. There is nothing that doth not shine in being, any more than anything is beautiful without the presence of beauty. Wherefore nothing can exist shorn from the divine presence. But distinction in the divinity are made by the method of discursive thought and are not reality. Very profound. Huh? Yes. There is nothing that doth not shine in being, any more than anything is beautiful without the presence of beauty. Wherefore nothing can exist shorn from the divine presence. But distinctions in the divinity are made by the method of discursive thought and are not reality. It's difficult to thread your way through his sentences and decide exactly what he means, but you can see how revolutionary the whole picture was.
Truth, beauty, and beauty.
Yes, right. Goodness. Well, the Roman Inquisition. And here again I have to beg pardon of those who may not be aware of the horrendous event that took place in this century, in that century, wherein the church decided that it would have to crack down on everyone who said or preached or taught or thought anything contrary to what the church taught or thought or said. So a great trial was held, a great what's called the Inquisition was held, and all the productions of the intellectual people of the day were subjected to the scrutiny of the Roman Curia, what we call now the Curia. So this began in 1542. The Roman Inquisition began in earnest in 1542 in order to counter all of the Protestantism that had taken place in the Reformation. It's sometimes called the Counter-Reformation. The Counter-Reformation is a movement, but the Inquisition was an actual operation, real. Surgical operation, which took place at that time under the power of the Pope's people. Heretics, and the heresies of the day were two main heresies of the day. One was called natural philosophy, which would of course attribute everything to principles of science and all the sciences. Nature, taking nature as something that can be studied apart from the Bible, from God and the Church, and deriving your philosophy from all of that that you find in by observation and experiment was the beginning of science. So it was called by the Church natural philosophy. And the other heresy was, of course, occultism, hermetic science. All of the thing that had to do with the occult, magic, and white or black, was all considered by the Church's heresy. Bruno was interested in both. Deeply interested in both. Religious wars in Europe raged for the whole of Bruno's adult life. For 35 years, there were religious wars going on all the way through Egypt, Italy, Alexandria, on up Italy, Greece, up into what we now know as modern Europe, England even. There were religious wars of various sorts going on with the forces, between the forces of Protestantism and the forces of the Church, the Orthodox. And Bruno was always for freedom of thought, everywhere. Freedom of not only of thought, but freedom of expression and freedom of imagination. And, you know, I have to tell you a very interesting fact that a century before Bruno was born, there is a record of there being 30,000 books in existence. 30,000 books had already been printed by the time Bruno was about a century before Bruno, 30,000 books had already been printed. Isn't that amazing? When you think how late the press was invented, how fast the printing of knowledge was spread.
Is it different titles or 30,000 of one thing?
No, 30,000 books, just books, not titles.
Okay, so
just books.
So 15,000 could be Bible.
Right. Well, yeah. Right. Okay. Just what's been printed. Yeah. Right. Yes. And that's a very important point. Not 30,000 titles. Okay. 30,000 books were in existence, and when Bruno had reached his maturity, there were 50 million.
The printing press.
50 million books were in existence when Bruno reached his maturity. So it was easy for the church to catch up with everybody. Well, he was invited to Venice, and that's how he got trapped. A wealthy senator, you know, of the Italian Senate, invited him to Venice to come and stay with him, because he said, I want to study your doctrines. And dear trusting Bruno went there. We don't know what lured him. Maybe money. He was always poor, never had any money. So being invited to a wealthy man's house with bread and breakfast, I mean, board and room, and all of that, and being asked to teach his patron was too much for him to resist. And he went to Venice. And Venice is in Italy, of course. And he went to Venice. And he stayed there some time, and he trusted this man and became very friendly with this man, the senator. But the senator was a plant. And he, you know, call a plant, he had already prepared his books for recording what Bruno said, and sent them to the Venice Inquisition. Venice, there was an Inquisition. See, the Inquisition was divided into city-states. There would be one in Rome, and there'd be one in Venice, and there'd be one in Naples, and so on. So this Venice, city-state of Venice, had a more liberal, less drastic, I would say more liberal, a less drastic Inquisition than the one in Rome. And so he managed to live in Venice for quite a long time. But when he realized that he had been betrayed and saw that the end was going to be death, he clearly saw the end would be death, because they were executing heretics right and left, burning them at the stake, letting them die in prison, all kinds of horrible things that I'm not going to tell you this morning were done, torture, and so on. But he saw this coming, and he, being a good Catholic, still a good Catholic, he apologized to the church authorities, the Venice Inquisition, and he prayed for mercy. He didn't recant anything that he said, but he prayed for mercy and apologized that he had offended them, and so on. Didn't help. He got no help, no mercy. He was treated to solitary confinement eventually in Venice. The Inquisition tried him trial after trial after trial, and all of the trials were stacked, all of the judges were stacked by cardinals from the Vatican and other kinds of officials who would be sure to condemn him. So all of the trials were very much of a farce. And then he was put into solitary in a little square room, just in the dark, no window. He was tortured. There was delay in all of his, long delays in all of the decisions made regarding him, so that he could molder there in the pit. Well, he had ample time to recant, and he thought that Pope Clement The eighth would be sympathetic to his cause, and he drafted a big paper and sent it to the Pope and said, "This is what I'm your servant, I'm your loyal, faithful subject, all of these things, but here's the truth." And of course, Pope Clement was an intellectual, and he entertained some interest in it, and he read it through. But even the Pope couldn't prevent. Even if he had wanted to, the Pope couldn't have prevented. So Bruno was taken out from his prison, dragged to Rome, put in prison again, and stayed in prison there for the longest time you can imagine, years. I think 8 years he stayed in prison, that whole. And then he was brought out and tortured, and a fire was lit under his feet and plenty of fuel put on, and he was burnt. Well, Bruno saw through the fantasies of the occult, even though he was very much interested in it and wrote about it. He also wrote treatises on the art of memory. There was a, you know, before the books were printed, people had to learn their lectures, they had to do their lectures and all of their study by memorizing. And the art of memory became an occult science. It became something that people studied on it on their own, on its own. And he was a writer, a composer of treatises on the power of memory. So he must have had himself a fantastic memory, and he wrote these books about it and taught the techniques of memorizing, some of which were known to the Vedic people in Vedic times, because they some of those mnemonic devices. Have you heard about those? They repeat a line, then drop a word, go back and repeat the line, then drop another word, then go back and drop another. That's one of the techniques.
It's interesting that this came at a time when writing proliferated, but right. That was the end of memory, was the beginning of writing.
Right.
We're going through something like that now with cyberspace and computers. Uh-huh. But men were known witnesses at trials, could, using their memory, could recall. Yeah. It was this, the winter that this tree fell, that this, yeah, and this cow,
right,
did that.
Exactly.
And also people who were very good at it would have jobs where they would walk through a warehouse and the other person,
that's right,
would say there are 3 bolts of hay, there's a thimble of this, this,
that's, and right,
walk out the other side and then write it down. They would say what was there. He was the auditor. That's where the word, because he could say back to you exactly what was,
right.
That's how they kept exact track of things.
Another technique he had was, you visualize, say, your parental home. And in this room, you're going to put things of this sort. And then in that room, you'll have the things of that sort. And so by going back and remembering the rooms of your house, you would chalk up the things in your memory that you needed to remember. We have no idea of this. That was what he was teaching. The church was against all of that sort of thing. They didn't want you to remember anything. And then, except what they taught you. Galileo revered him, but did not follow him. Oh, I forgot to say this. He saw through the fantasies of the occult, the imaginations. He said, "The power of the human mind is the only force at work in so-called magic." Imagine, this is modern psychology. The human mind is the only force at work.
Well, that's like in India, the magical men, who can do incredible things,
yes,
that seem like magic, but
yeah,
in fact, it's just the power of their minds.
It's a... Yeah, it's what you call mass, see, hypnosis or something like that. They call it mass hypnosis.
But I mean, there's some who are actually doing
that. Oh, that you mean? Yeah, okay.
But it's all because of the power,
right,
that they've developed in their mind.
Well, I must hurry through here. I got to tell you, Galileo, of course, was the first great empiricist. He was really the first experimenter and empiricist. He rejected all mysticism, much more so than Bruno. And only after Bruno's execution was Copernicus's book placed on the index, which means that they only realized revolutionary, yeah, that's right, revolutionary, Copernicus was after Bruno died, after Bruno's ideas came out. Bruno had thought experiments. He made some thought experiments, and I like to compare those to those of quantum mechanics. Here's one of them. He imagined himself floating above and beyond the Earth. As he drifted closer and closer to the moon, he visualized it growing larger as the Earth became smaller. From the surface of the moon itself, the Earth seemed like a satellite, and the moon had taken on the dimension of the Earth. Traveling farther still, he imagined both the Earth and the moon as specks of light. Eventually, they disappeared into endless night. Yeah. Of later philosophers, Leibniz was the most influenced by Bruno.
Leibniz
was a Western philosopher. L-E-I-B-N-I-Z. One of the most famous of Western philosophers. Not that he followed Bruno, but that he was influenced by his radicalness and his discoveries. And also, Leibniz had something to do with the invention of calculus.
Yes. Parallel with
Descartes. Yes. So calculus ultimately can be traced perhaps back to Bruno in a certain sense. Bruno is appreciated now more than ever has been in history. In 1999, get this, in 1999, 400 years to the day, a tribute ceremony, day of his burning. A tribute ceremony was held in very bad weather in Michigan, and it was given, many, many big speeches were given, and the Vatican representative came and said, it was a matter of regret.
Galileo was recognized.
The church has come that far. It was a matter of regret. Yes. We regret that we tortured and burned. And I close with a quotation from Walt Whitman. As America's mental courage is so indebted above all current lands and peoples to the noble army of old world martyrs past, how incumbent on us that we clear those martyrs' lives and names and hold them up for reverent admiration as well as beacons. And typical of this, and standing for it and all, perhaps, Giordano Bruno may well be put today and to come in our new world's thankfulest heart and memory. Signed, Walt Whitman.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Comments, questions.
One comment. You said that he had difficulty calling him a sage because of his fiery temperament and because of his combativeness.
Well, you see, I really was looking for people like Kusa and people like Eckhart, and I thought that we would find, I'm a little disappointed, because I thought that I would find more figures in the history of the Renaissance and in the Western culture who were, like Kusa, both mystics and philosophers, modern philosophers.
When you said that, I thought, however, of Jesus Christ, who was a troublemaker, who drove the money changers out of the temple and caused such a ruckus that they had to finally crucify him, and that's the same inn that Bruno came to.
And even Swami Vivekananda is said to have occasionally roared at people.
Yes, I don't know whether he could match Bruno, but... I called it one of the Western sages. I'm a little disappointed that I didn't find more mysticism in his life, more of a depth. He's up on the surface too much for me. I would rather have a person of depth. But once I'd started it and announced it, I had to go on with it.
But more in Bruno than in Thomas More.
Oh, yes, there's more of Bruno and Thomas More, I think. Yes, I think so, yes. Because otherwise he couldn't have got those truths. He couldn't have penetrated to that depth of the spiritual truth. Yes, I think he touched Brahman. I think he really did touch Brahman. But whether he, I don't know.
I think he touched depth, but his style was different.
Yes.
His style was different. Yeah.
And also, he's not having any personal God, you see, not having any... A truck with a personal God puts him in a different camp from the others that we have studied.
But would you not say that he was spiritual even though he was not mystic?
I'd say he was spiritual. He isn't ostensibly a mystic. We know nothing of his own inner private life. Of his life of prayer, we know nothing. Unfortunately, because the church didn't want us to know anything.
Just like a proto-scientist, but
right.
Also a spiritual person.
I think so. Otherwise he couldn't have had that knowledge.
Yeah.
That knowledge only comes from spirit.
Many scientists are not mystics, but they have a spiritual element to them.
Yeah.
I think it has something to do with of dedication to truth.
That's right. Dedication, exactly.
He went to the stake rather than recant his beliefs, his fundamental beliefs.
Exactly.
Galileo, on the other hand, recanted his beliefs and just went into house arrest and lived his life in relative comfort to do his experiments and his work. I mean, it's a different style in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But Bruno, think about what he went through. You're talking about Venice and being in the dungeons and transported, betrayed. Yeah. What would that do to you? He was betrayed over and over again.
Okay. Because he had that positive... He was so convinced of the truth of this. He said, "Well, you'll recognize this."
That dedication to truth was what elevated him above others.
Very bold, very bold.
Before we say our benediction, I want to announce that we are feeding our volunteers, and board meeting will be held in here. I don't know how much food. We hope there's enough. Volunteers in here. The nursing home crew in the kitchen, and those who are meeting with the representative of overseas families, immigrant families, in the library. So. You get your food from the central table. We'll have it on the central table. And then go to those places for your meetings, if you please do that.